Okay, we're going to get started. Representative Ruth, you're the only bill author in the room right now, so I'm going to... Oh, Laura just walked in. Laura, if you want to come to the table, I'll start with you. Our members were one short of a quorum. I'll interrupt the testimony when we do have a quorum. I will start with Representative Broad's bill, House File 1243. Representative Broad, we don't have a quorum yet, so I'll interrupt you when we do, but we'd like you to start explaining your bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, not multiply plural here because there's not very many, but essentially the bill that we have before you will open up the HOV lanes to the purposes and uses of hybrid vehicles regardless of how many passengers they actually have in those vehicles. And the purpose of the HOV lanes that were put in, I believe it was in the 80s, was to encourage people to ride together in order to lessen the use of gas, but also to improve the environment. And Madam Chair, I do have with me here today Betsy Parker from the Minnesota Department of Transportation to discuss the bill in specifics.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Betsy Parker from the Department of Transportation. First of all, I would like to say that Governor Pawlenty strongly supports this bill, and MnDOT, as the manager of the HOV lanes, also supports the bill. The bill does define hybrid vehicles, and it also allows the use of HOV lanes by hybrid vehicles. The purpose for that is really twofold. One is that it encourages people to buy hybrid vehicles, and hybrid vehicles are very good for improving air quality. They are both more fuel efficient and they produce fewer emissions. And that is important in the Twin Cities because we have been an air quality attainment area in past years where we in the Met Council must make sure that our transportation plan meets federal air quality standards. So we are supporting this bill, and we feel that it does improve air quality in the Twin Cities. The bill does provide that an owner of a hybrid vehicle may request a distinctive decal to identify his vehicle so that it can be separated from the single occupant vehicles that will also be using the HOV lanes but paying a toll. And the cost of that decal will be $15. The bill also provides that a person may not operate a vehicle that displays a decal issued under this section if that decal was not issued for that vehicle, so that if a family has more than one vehicle that they wish to operate, more than one hybrid vehicle that they wish to operate in those lanes, they must purchase a decal for each vehicle. And the bill also addresses some concerns that have been expressed about the possibility that there might be so many hybrid vehicles that they would fill up the HOV lanes and reduce the speed that the high occupancy vehicles could travel. And the bill does address that in Subdivision 5 by providing that it expires July 31st, 2007. And MnDOT has estimated that probably only about a quarter of the hybrid vehicles purchased in the state would actually be operated on that HOV lane. And as of a year or two ago, there were only, I believe, 300 hybrid vehicles in Minnesota at the time, although, of course, the numbers are expected to rise.
Excuse me, Ms. Parker, we do have a quorum. I'll call the meeting to order, and Representative Anderson moves approval of the minutes from the April 5th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does pass. The minutes are approved. And then I will move House File 1243 to be heard by the committee, and members will be laying this over for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill. Sorry for the interruption, Ms. Parker.
That's all right, Madam Chair. I only had one remaining thing to say, and that is Congress is also looking at the use of hybrid vehicles in HOV lanes with an eye to both encouraging it and regulating it. The House has passed its version of the Federal Transportation Reauthorization Bill, which encourages the purchase of fuel-efficient and more cars that are better for air quality by allowing their use in HOV lanes, but it does provide that if the speeds in those lanes is degraded to less than 10 miles per hour below the established speed limit, then their use over a period of time, and it occurs during peak hours, then their use must be discontinued by the state. The Senate is expected to pass similar language, so there is protection against that happening, and we do support this bill.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Parker. You mentioned a $15 fee for a decal, and reviewing the fiscal note, I see no, that's not addressed in the fiscal note at all, and I'm wondering, you know, who will pay for the design and the administration of the decal, and how you settled on the $15 fee.
Madam Chair, I believe that the number was settled on in conversation with the governor's office about what would be an appropriate fee, and I believe the department will absorb the cost of the decal because we feel it is a nominal cost.
And Ms. Parker, where does the $15 go when it's paid?
Madam Chair, I thought it went in the trunk highway fund.
Oh. Ms. Parker, the fiscal note that we have in front of us here today is on the Senate bill, and it was dated 3/24/05. I'm assuming that it reflects what's in this bill. And it all it talks about is the loss to the special revenue account, that being the account that is set aside to take the revenues to benefit the 394 corridor, of which after expenses are paid, half goes to upgrades for transit in that corridor and half goes to upgrade for roads in that corridor. And so I don't see anything in the fiscal note that reflects that fee. Ms. Parker, it may be that the fiscal note was done before you settled on a fee. I don't see any fee reflected in the bill. Maybe what we need to do, as long as we don't have an answer to the question before us, maybe we need to either, certainly this is being laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, but I think we need to figure out what would be raised, what would be the cost of designing and administering the decal, and would it actually be a positive or negative to the Trunk Highway Fund? Representative Bratz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a very fair assessment. I think the fiscal note, as I see it, was excluding the amendment that was put on in regards to the fee. I would be most certainly happy to inquire and get a more firm fiscal note based on our bill with the amendments as they sit right now.
All right. Thank you. Members, are there any questions? Representative Abrams.
Well, Madam Chair, basically a couple of comments rather than a question. You know, when I first heard this issue, it had a lot of facial appeal. But then I started to think about it a little bit, Representative Broad. And, you know, I don't necessarily oppose something that Governor Pawlenty wants lightly. But currently, if you are to try to buy a Prius, which is the most common hybrid car available in Minnesota, you probably have to wait 6 or 9 months, and you would have to pay above the manufacturer's suggested retail price. And what this bill does is it is going to give all the automobile manufacturers and sales in the state another opportunity to advertise, get this, and you're going to get this benefit, this spiff, and it's going to keep the price up. if this was a situation in which there was this great new technology available, and I support the technology, I think it's great, I think that hybrids and fuel cells, etc., are the future, but if there were difficulty in selling the vehicles and the technology, I think that's when you offer the incentives, not when it's the hottest car and the hottest technology that's available. That's kind of the first issue that I have. And the second issue I have is you can have all the nice words you want to have about what they're doing in Congress. There is, if you will, in the one of the 50 laboratories of the states, in one of those laboratories, Virginia, they have allowed this, and they are now in the absolute soup in which thousands of Virginians have bought these vehicles reliant on being able to use these lanes, and these lanes are now as clogged, if not more clogged, than the regular passenger lanes. So as much as this has some facial appeal, and I absolutely applaud people who buy hybrids, I have rented a hybrid. I was telling Representative Hornsby, I think we rented from the same place in Southern California. I'm just worried about those two issues. So maybe you can maybe answer them. And, you know, there are other hybrids coming out. You know, Lexus is coming out with one, and Ford is coming out with an SUV hybrid, and I would suspect that the General Motors has one or two, but you know, I'm concerned about both of those issues, Representative Brock. Could you help me out a little?
Representative Brock.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Abrams. I think those are very fair concerns. One thing I would say in regards to keeping the price up, I think that would be fine if there were only still one or two type of vehicles out there, but what we're seeing in the market is an expansion of the market and an expansion of the number of vehicles and the type of and the number of actually manufacturers who are putting these cars out into the market. So that's one thing, is I think the market is absolutely changing in regards to hybrid vehicles, whereas you could get a Prius and maybe one other vehicle, and maybe Representative Hornstein can help me on the names, over the past couple years. Over the next few years, you'll be able to get a Lexus, you'll be able to get a Ford Explorer, which are currently on the market. You'll be able to get, I think it's 7 or 8 new models of hybrids out there, and so I think that in and of itself, the competition will help drive the prices down for the market. Secondarily, in regards to providing incentives when this which may keep the price up there, I actually, when I look at it, there's already a premium being paid for these vehicles, whether it's, you know, I think it's between $2,500 and $3,500 more that people are paying to drive one of these vehicles that is better for the environment, gets better gas mileage, uses less gas, creating less reliance on foreign oil. I think those are all good things, and this small incentive is one way to help offset that premium that people are paying. In regards to Virginia, I've done a little bit of research as to what's going on out there, and I don't know that we can draw a true correlation between what's happening out there and what's happening here due to the way that they use their roads and to the congestion that's already currently on those roads. Before they put their law into effect, it's my understanding that their HOV lanes were already fully at capacity, whereas ours are definitely underutilized. So I think that there's a little bit of a difference there. And also, when I look at some of the information that's out there in the news stories in Virginia, a lot of the concern isn't necessarily about the hybrid vehicles. It's more about enforcement and the vehicles who aren't hybrids and don't have the HOV3, I think they have, the three drivers or the three riders. And I actually have been reading more about the fact that if you step up enforcement, it would help create less congestion in those lanes as well.
Thank you. Representative Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you again, Representative Broad, for bringing this forward. I think Representative Abrams does raise some very good points, and you know, we tried with the tax incentive, and I don't think that's necessarily the answer, although, you know, I think it's a good way to bring the cost down. But I do think we need to promote these vehicles, and I think the provision that you put in with the both the sunset and the speed limit issue will help get it if we have a repeat of Virginia here. It's addressed in the bill. But I also think it's been a very limited niche market up till now. I mean, it's still, I think, 0.25% of the total, you know, passenger fleet that's out there. And it's just been, I think, primarily folks that may have already an interest in environmentalism or interest in new technology. These are the folks that are buying these, I think, by and large, still on the waiting list. And I think we need to get these hybrid vehicles, you know, into the mainstream so that the day-to-day buyer who is really price-sensitive or incentive-sensitive will be really considering these. And as we get more choices, and right now it's basically just the small cars. You have a Prius and the Honda Civic, and now we have a Ford small SUV. So there are some limited choices from the manufacturers. But I think there is a proper role for the state in saying we believe in this technology. We believe that in vehicles that reduce emissions 50% to 90% and get anywhere from 35 to 45 and higher miles per gallon. Those are important values. It's important for the state to get behind it. And I think this is a reasonable bill that at least starts to move us in the right direction, especially if we're not going to do the sales tax exemption. So I thank you, Representative Broad. I think it's a good bill.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And even though I'm going to make a couple of remarks here, Representative Broad, I will vote for this bill. Because I always support the governor's initiative, or almost always, these vehicles are already getting a tax, an operating brake, because they're not paying the same gas taxes, same gasoline taxes as another user, charged V6 or V8 gasoline engine. They're very parsimonious with the use of gasoline, which is an advantage in one way, but it's also a disadvantage to the state. We don't have that built into our costs here. I don't think on the fiscal note, but I'm surprised that we don't. But I'm also wondering this $16,000. And beyond that, what do we do when we get to electric cars and that sort of stuff, which is, does all the things you say and uses even less gasoline? I wonder about that. But why do we only show $16,000 on this? I can't imagine that that is the, that must just be something they looked in the mirror and said, boy, 10 cars using this by how many? The average take on the HLV will be $16,000. I mean, how do you arrive at that?
Representative Earhart, it's on the back on page 2 of the fiscal note that they estimate 30 vehicles per day, and that it would be the loss of revenue that they would pay if they were a regular vehicle paying the upcharge in the hot lane.
I never read the backs of these things.
All right. Are there any additional questions by committee members? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to this bill?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Seeing none with that, I'm sorry, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Broder, Ms. Parker. It talks about violation, and my concern is how and who is going to be enforcing the decal that's going to be on it. I mean, I got to believe that the State Patrol, the past years that I've been here, been saying they've been short of troopers, and I don't know where the DPS or whoever's going to be out there looking at these people to watch for this and saying, oh, well, they're exempt. They don't need it because they got the certain decal. What is it that's going to, how are we going to enforce the violation on putting this hybrid car on the HOV lane?
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Anderson, I guess I don't anticipate any difference or change in enforcement for those lanes. They're currently being enforced in that they're trying to make sure that folks are using the lanes that have the right number of people during the right times of the day. And so actually the decal will give the agencies, enforcing agencies, an ability to see very visibly that the car is actually eligible to be there versus having to stop them and ask them why they only have one passenger and saying, well, I actually am a hybrid vehicle. So I don't anticipate that it would change the patterns of enforcement one bit.
Any additional questions?
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Broad, I got to believe that if I talk to the State Highway Patrol, it's going to be a little different. But anyway, my concern is that, and the fact that we're exempting these vehicles going on just because they're a hybrid car. I think we come up with a better incentive than that, I think.
Thank you. Any additional comments or questions? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 1243 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill. Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Bill's laid over, and Representative Broad, if you could make sure we get an updated fiscal note as soon as possible, we'd appreciate that.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Abrams, you're next. And members, Representative Abrams is bringing forward House File 946. There's a lot of provisions in this bill. I would expect that we would confine our comments and questions to the most part to those issues before the Transportation Finance Committee as opposed to the Tax Committee. In addition, given that I believe everybody has heard this before, I would like to pay particular attention to anything that's new or updated, and hope that we can move on with this fairly rapidly. Representative Abrams, I see here there's an A1 amendment in our packet as well.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move that House File number 946 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you.
I would also move the 946 A1 amendment to clean the bill up a little bit because of some personal issues. I haven't had a real opportunity to go through it in the manner in which I normally go through a bill, but I'm sure that we'll find some more issues as they go along. So I'd like to move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. And Representative Abrams, you want to briefly explain what the amendment accomplishes?
It takes out some extraneous language that found its way in dealing with qualified business and wages paid, because it said for every employee. There's also, quite frankly, Madam Chair, a tax issue in here, which gave this new district the authority to levy property taxes within the district, and I don't think that that was the intent of anybody. We wanted to give it the port authority status, but we didn't, so that they can issue bonds, et cetera, but we didn't want them to be able to have the full faith and credit port authority powers.
Right,
so
well,
that's what the two sections do.
Thank you, Representative Abrams. And even though this isn't a tax committee, I think we can probably all support the A1 amendment. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Abrams.
Madam Chair, rather than going through the bill, let me just give a brief introduction and then have Maury Anderson give you some of the nuts and bolts. We have a unique asset in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and in fact, in the state of Minnesota, as to our geographic location in general and the location of MSP in particular. There are negatives, as Representative Larson can tell you, about having a postage stamp airport literally in a first ring suburbs. But one of the benefits that you have is that it can be a tool for economic development. What House File 946 does is it establishes an international economic development zone so that air freight can move more freely into and out of the state. Now, before somebody thinks that this is going to generate 20 or 30 flights a day, that is incorrect. If there were one 747 a week filled with new cargo, particularly for international flights, that would be considered a success, and two flights a week would be a huge success. Currently, our manufacturers who are either selling goods or getting goods have to truck most of the cargo in from Chicago. What this will allow is, I believe, a 1 million square foot cargo handling facility to be built within 60 or 90 minutes of MSP Airport. That would locate the facility probably in Rosemont, but there may be a location or two in Anoka County that would take a look at it. One of the other questions that comes up is, why MSP? Why not Rochester? Why not St. Cloud? The issue has to deal with the runway thickness, in that if you're going to be flying fully loaded cargo 747s, you have to have a landing strip that can accommodate it. They can't accommodate that heavy a plane at either Rochester or St. Cloud, although if this was built in Rosemont, I would suspect that some smaller planes could conceivably use the Rochester airport. So that's why MSP would be used. Now, there's a second transportation issue that's in the bill outside of the air freight issue, and I don't have the amendment for it now, but I will work with you, Madam Chair, as we go on. There was a traffic impact study required in the bill last year. I don't have the language with me today, Madam Chair. The idea is that this will put some pressure on some of the roads in Dakota and Scott counties, particularly the east-west roads that go through that town. It may be necessary for MnDOT to take a look at perhaps designated one of those roads as a state highway. That probably ought to be designated a state highway anyway. But there should be some comfort language in here that Scott and Dakota County will have some say into a highway impact study, et cetera. That is the brief overview, and Maury Anderson can give a little bit more flesh on the bare bones description that I gave.
Thank you very much, Representative Abrams. And I actually took the bill home last night and read it, and a lot of what we talked about last year is actually still included in this draft. I think we're fairly close, and so I appreciate you addressing that issue. And with that, Mr. Anderson, if you want to share your comments, and again, remember that everybody in this committee has heard this issue a number of times before.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Maury Anderson, and I'm here representing the Metropolitan Area Foreign Trade Zone Commission today. And I think just very briefly, a couple additional points. Building the RDC, the Regional Distribution Center, is really about accessing global markets for Minnesota businesses, and it's really not about developing anything for a single business, but really designed to serve all of those businesses that, in fact, engage in international trade. And if you look at what's going on in international trade, I suppose not a lot of secrets. Trade is projected to be up somewhere around 7.5% annually across the world, air trade, air cargo. 54% of the manufacturers in North America are expanding globally, and right now, I suppose as a footnote, China accounts for a fourth of all air cargo worldwide, and just in the last couple of years, Dallas-Fort Worth has had a 51% increase in trade and flights with China, as an example. And global trade is also in the process of really creating new alliances around the world, both in terms of the air cargo industry and the airplanes that are being used. Now, if you look at that environment and you compare it with our area in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the metro area in Minnesota, I guess, our air cargo is decreasing and has been for several years. We have no international flights going out of here except what goes out in the belly of passenger planes. We have an environment where Minnesota is recognized with a lot of high technology, high value products. And in the air cargo business, IT products account for about 40% of the volume and 75% of the value. And frankly, having access to those global markets ought to be a Minnesota thing based on our industrial base. The rest of the world is gaining jobs in this area, and we've in fact lost jobs in this area. So that's the primary reason for considering and doing this. From an individual business perspective, there are probably three things that they look at and three primary cost items. One is inventory control, one is transportation costs, now incorporated in that very significantly are security and fuel costs, and then the administration of those. For Minnesota businesses, because we simply don't have access to some of these markets in an effective way, all of those costs for Minnesota businesses are higher than they should be because of our lack of access into the marketplace. The other thing that the regional distribution center ought to do is stimulate new growth in new businesses, and it really ought to be complementary to the Job Z zones in terms of enhancing who the Job Z's can attract into there. So it's really a marketing tool that the Job Z's and other economic development activities can use. And then I think finally, the RDC has the opportunity to expand our regional reach. If we had it, our reach would probably go as far west as Denver, and certainly could possibly go south into Missouri area and encompass kind of the traditional upper Midwest in a very significant way. So our economic watershed would also significantly expand. And then finally, security is a huge issue, and it's been a debate nationally and locally by all the political parties. And frankly, the RDC gives us an opportunity to solve the security problem for air cargo, I think, in a very significant and a very unique way. And I think there's a letter circulating around that says that TSA actually probably agrees with us that they would like to pursue that with us as well.
Right.
So those are the real points.
Thank you. Representative Abrams, do you have additional people that want to testify? I had two additional people on the list.
If they can be short, that would probably be a good idea, ma'am.
It would be a very good idea, Representative Abrams. But
as they're coming forward, there is one other point I'd like to make as the witnesses come forward, and that is that this is permissive language. If there is no private company that is going to come in...
Excuse me, just a minute. If those testifiers will work their way to the front wall, Representative Abrams, we keep moving in this committee.
Yeah. If private dollars don't come in, it doesn't get built. All this says is that we're putting the tool in place so that it can be built. There's no state dollars involved. There's no local dollars involved. Yes, there's a pretty good economic incentive if you do it, but it is wholly the private sector that will decide if, in fact, there is market conditions to support this type of facility in Minnesota.
All right. Thank you, Representative Abrams. Sir, if you'd state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Lenzen. I'm Executive Vice President for Liberty Diversified Industries. I also serve as a Twin West Chamber of Commerce volunteer representative for the Metropolitan Coalition of Chambers, and serve as chair of the MCC. MCC is an association of 24 metro area chambers of commerce representing business in more than 60 communities. We formed 2 years ago as an advocate for significant investment and improvement in the Twin City transportation infrastructure. In our May 2003 report, Twin City Transportation System, a Business Perspective on Meeting Regional Needs, the Metropolitan Coalition of Chambers laid out our findings, principles, and recommendations for improving the regional transportation system. As part of our findings, MCC addressed the importance of improving the region's ability to handle growing volumes of air cargo. MCC urges your support of House File 946. Twin City businesses that ship to international markets are at a disadvantage when it comes to our transportation network. It takes 6 days for cargo to reach its destination from the Twin Cities, and 89% of the Twin Cities' international air cargo is trucked to Chicago and other gateways. Establishing a regional air freight distribution center in the Twin Cities would prevent those delays from getting worse. A regional distribution center would encourage existing custom companies to maintain their distribution services in the region and attract new international companies to the region. A regional distribution center would consolidate the region's international cargo. This would enable it to negotiate for direct international service, making MSP an international air cargo hub. Such a hub could reduce travel time for international freight from 6 days to 2 to 3 days. On behalf of MCC, I urge your support of House File 946. It's important legislation that will help the economic vitality of our region. Thank you for letting me address the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Luxon. Representative Ann Larson, did you have a question to this testifier, or was it for the bill author?
Just the bill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, sir. President Abrams, is Mr. Anderson here? And would he like to add a few comments, sir? No, I'm saying no. We have a yes.
I think it's yes. Madam Chair, members
Thank
of the
you.
Committee, I guess I wasn't expecting to testify, but...
if you'll state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Stephen Anderson. I'm the administrator for the Greater Metropolitan Foreign Trade Zone Commission, and I'm here to basically support the bill. And I think there's been significant testimony before that I don't anticipate any need for me to add much more than what's already been said. Thank you
very much. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Abrams and committee members. You've been graceful in spending a lot of time listening to me talk about how this airport impacts my district, and Representative Abrams was right. Usually those are negative impacts. We hear everything. Even when a pin drops at the Metropolitan Airport or at MSP, we are very aware of any change in activity there. And I will continue to push this legislature on the noise issues that affect our community, and I appreciate the patience that you've had. But one thing that I would also say is that, you know, in 1996, when the decision was made to keep this airport here, it is important for us to acknowledge with that decision that we need to have the facility be as successful as possible. And part of that is having it and allowing it to enhance its ability to grow as an economic engine. And this is precisely the kind of economic opportunities that should be available to our business community in Minnesota. I think it would be very positive from a job standpoint for us to see the establishment of this opportunity. And then, Representative Abrams, you're right, it's permissive. If the market forces bring it to bear, then it's a good thing. And so Madam Chair, because occasionally I'm critical of anything that relates to Minneapolis International Airport, I just want to let committee members know that I appreciate the author's work in this and support this legislation, and think that generally it's if this were to be established and developed, the entire state would benefit.
Thank you very much, Mr. Representative Larson. Are there any additional questions or comments? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Abrams, or your testifiers. How many international exporters now are, it was mentioned in testimony, that they're going now and sending their goods and stuff by truck down to Chicago? How much are we losing? How many are there to begin with? And how much are we? How much is the state losing by this? These people going down to Chicago that we could be gaining? I know we're exempting the tax situation if we get the right combination of people wanting to come forward to put this in place. But I'm wondering what we've been losing in the past.
Representative Abrams.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, what I have read, and maybe Maury Anderson could fill in the blanks, is that about 90% of our international air cargo is currently being trucked through Chicago. If there is just one 747 per week that uses the facility, the net economic gain to the state of Minnesota is $100 million to our gross state product. And so, you know, it is difficult to understand exactly how much stuff you can put into one 747, but it is a lot. And one 747 per week would be a win. Two 747s a week would be a home run, and three would be absolute nirvana. At least from what I've heard, there probably is enough demand currently for one to two per week, is what I've been told. So, that kind of gives you an order of magnitude of the size of the facility and the amount of exports that go out. Because it also gives you an idea of how big a 747-400 fully loaded is when it's configured for air freight. It's big.
I understand.
Representative Anderson, did that answer your question?
Yes. I just for clarification, I'm just wondering, is this going to be a private enterprise that is going to be pushing the billing of the entity, or is there going to be some state involvement also other than exempting and allowing this to take place?
Madam Chair, the economic incentives are in the bill. The capital all has to be private.
Okay.
Thank you. Any additional questions of the bill author? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do I understand now that Medtronics wants to ship something internationally? They truck it to this new facility and it flies out of there rather than trucking it to Chicago? Is that the idea?
Representative Abrams.
Madam Chair, the stuff would be trucked probably to the RDC in order to be packaged and then would be trucked from the facility to MSP where it would take off. That would probably be that would probably be how stuff would go out, and as it comes in, it would be coming off of the 747 in large pallets, be trucked down to the RDC, and the various entities at the RDC would split up the load and send it on its way.
Yeah, sure. We don't have any flights going out of this new.
This is about a 1 million square initially. A 1 million square foot distribution center. That's it. There's no way, you know, maybe a helicopter, Representative Earhart, okay. but no planes.
Okay, thank you. Any additional questions? Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak in opposition to this bill? Representative Abrams.
I would renew my, just so you know, this will go to the tax committee. It's my current intent to have this as part of the public finance bill so that we'll only be taking one vote on a large bill rather than having 15 bills floating around. It's more efficient for the committee. It's more efficient for the floor. So I would renew my motion that House File 946, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
All right. Any additional questions or comments? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Abrams. The next item on our agenda is House File 1400, Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson, I see here you have a DE1 amendment. Would you like the committee to adopt that to get the bill in the shape in which you'd like to discuss it?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay,
if you would, please.
Members, I'll move consideration of House File 1400. In addition, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Nelson. And members, this will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill. Given the fact that we've just seen a DE1 amendment, we need to get an updated fiscal note on that before we know what we can do with it. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, Pete Nelson, Chisago County. Once again, from the Swedish Riviera. Before you is House File 1400, and I'll put through some of it fairly quick for you. In Section 1, it applies to adding equestrian equipment and supplies to what is currently allowed on trailers carrying. In Section 2, just a reflection of the changes made in Section 1, in Section 3, it actually works off of a 2004 legislative work that we did, and it is something that MnDOT Bridge and Office proposes that we put this language in, and it helps their department work more efficiently and gives them better opportunity to keep track of weights on vehicles. Section 4 makes some technical corrections and specifies that in forest products it includes wood chips. Section 5, we have some permits. And in Section 6 is a real big part that we have as far as the reason that we've got a DE from on this coming out of the other committee. And it deals with special paper products and a vehicle permit, Madam Chair and members. And I have with me a number of people that would like to speak to you on the importance of this. I think it's important for everybody to note that technically this is allowing a pilot study to be done as far as transporting certain paper products on a specific route within the state of Minnesota. This is something that MnDOT has worked with the people that will be manufacturing these vehicles, and in fact the vehicles will be manufactured, probably what we maybe should do for a lot more often anyhow, with the axle spacing and distribution of the weight within the vehicle. But it also, which carries a great economic impact for possibility for the state of Minnesota. And to that point, I think, first of all, I'd like to ask Representative Solberg to make a few comments. And then if you'd indulge us to have a couple other people to speak to that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, you've requested a half hour for your hearing. That's what you're going to get today, so I suggest that you divvy out the time accordingly and leave time for questions.
And my watch said I've used 15 seconds. Is that about what you're
saying? You're past that. Representative Solberg, welcome to the committee, and I know this is an important issue for you and your district, and I've heard from some of your constituents and am familiar with the issue, and we're glad that you're here today to help with present this to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you, and thanks to Representative Nelson for inviting me as well. If you recall right, within the first couple of weeks of Governor Pawlenty's administration, Land and Paper Company announced a huge layoff, and both Senator Saxog and I and the governor went up and met with the company. And the governor appointed a task force to see how we can make the paper companies and the forest products industry in Minnesota more competitive with the world market. We've been working on several different issues of that. One of those issues, of course, is competition with our foreign brothers and sisters in Finland and Germany and other areas. Right now it is cheaper for somebody who has a plant, my understanding, in Indiana to get paper from Finland, ship it on the ocean, put it on a train in New York or other ports, Baltimore, get it in the Indianapolis area, than it is for us in northern Minnesota to ship it to Indianapolis. And we know we are in that world market. We are doing several things to be able to make that paper industry and wood products industry more competitive. UPM Kymeny is a parent company of Land and Paper Company. Their headquarters are in Finland, and they are looking at the opportunity in the world to build another paper machine. We want to be able to be positioned to be in line for that. And with that in mind, I have with me the Minnesota, CEO of Blandon. I don't know what his title is. I know he's been working very hard to try to get this in line for UPM Kymeny, and his name is John Maher, and I'd like to have him do the presentation.
Thank you, Representative Solberg, and I've had Mr. Maher hanging around my office as well. Unfortunately, my schedule hasn't allowed much time for me to spend with him, but I know he's working diligently on this.
I'm sure within the last couple of days he's listened and found out how the legislative process
works. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Maher. I'm Senior Vice President for UPM, and I'm the General Manager of Brown and Paper. And I'd like to thank Representative Solberg for just giving me a promotion. I hope I get a raise that goes along with it. As Representative Solberg already stated, we did have massive layoffs at the mill in 2003. That was as a result of having to close two old paper machines. We still run two paper machines, but it was crystal clear to us back then, and I think also to the Grand Rapids community, that in order to keep the mill running, we're going to need continuous reinvestment. And that brings me to globalization. Globalization in a lot of people's minds has to do with global markets and competing for customers around the world and competing with other companies around the world. And that's true. 25 years ago, we would have told you that our major competitors were in Wisconsin. And today, I think major competitors come from all over the world. But the second part of globalization and what it means to us in Grand Rapids is also competition for capital investment. We are part of UPM. Although UPM is primarily owned by American Mutual Fund companies, we're a big company that's headquartered in Finland and does business, has production facilities in 16 countries and does business in almost 170 countries around the world. This company has the ability to invest capital wherever it finds and identifies a real competitive advantage. To that end, we back in 2003 as a management team decided we were going to try to put our best foot forward and be one of those locations competing for capital investment. We've identified four factors, fiber, energy, labor, and logistics costs as some of the things that need to be done to improve our stead. Now, we've had very good success in three areas. Our logistics today is a serious disadvantage. As Representative Solberg mentioned, other parts of UPM and other companies can actually make the 5,000-mile shipment over water into our home market for less money than we can out of Grand Rapids. And as we analyze that, we know for a fact that we can negotiate much better rail rates out of the Port of Baltimore than we can negotiate out of Grand Rapids, Minnesota. And the reason is we have one railroad available to us in Grand Rapids. Baltimore has two, minimum. Our solution is not to take this line down. We've already started trucking paper from Grand Rapids to Duluth. Duluth has four railroads available, and we are able to get decent rates out of Duluth. What this bill would do is allow us, instead of trucking with conventional trucks, which could be up to 70 a day, we would like, for this bill, to run specially designed heavyweight trucks, thereby reduce the number of loads, but also not tear up the highway. I think two points that I'd like to leave you with. By passing this legislation, I think you as a legislator have the ability to send a message to my headquarters in Helsinki that Minnesota is open for business. I also think you send a very powerful message to workers in Grand Rapids at my mill, but also all of northern Minnesota, that we're working very hard down here in St. Paul to keep our jobs from going overseas. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair and members, just very briefly, in your packet you should have a couple of packages in there, and one is a white sheet on this proposed pilot commodity corridor done by the University of Minnesota, and I think that's very important to realize that the operative word in this, that it is not opening the whole state, it is a specific area for a specific pilot project. I think it's also important that we remember that these vehicles are specially designed for this. And in fact, it may be something, as I mentioned earlier, we may want to look at it as a state and a transportation system. And with that, Madam Chair and members, we would stand for questions.
And Representative Nelson, if you have somebody that can testify to the specifics of the amendment and what you're allowing and why it makes sense for those roads, I think that would be helpful for this community. We've got the economic development piece, but we are the transportation committee and are concerned about these weight loads on our infrastructure and the process and why this bill both meets the needs of economic development but still respecting the investment that we make in our roads in the state.
Madam Chair, if I could just divert for a second. In the back room, we have the Greenway close-up group that's watching this. Greenway, many of their father's relatives work at Blandon. But I taught some of these good students behind me, so they're very, very good.
And Representative Solberg, I did turn to Ms. Gruen and say, who's the group here? Because usually we get a note, so you say they're the Greenview...
Greenway
School.
Greenway of Coloring. Yeah.
Okay, well, welcome to the committee. We're glad you're here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think probably if we had Betsy Parker speak to the last section 6, also let you know exactly where they stand on this.
All right, thank you. Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. Sections 1 through 5 of this bill are part of MnDOT's housekeeping bill, just so you know that. Section 6 is not, but the department has been working with people from Blandon Paper and from DNR in order to address the technical concerns about this bill, because we were told that there was a great desire to haul a lot of additional weight over the road from Grand Rapids to Duluth paper products. and we were asked to assist with determining what would be the best way to do that without providing any unnecessary damage to roads and bridges on the way. And so we have done that, and we do have one of our pavement engineers and a bridge engineer here if you have any specific technical questions, because there are questions like that I cannot answer. But basically what I will tell you is that we agreed that for technical purposes there were two kinds of vehicles that the department would find completely acceptable for providing this transportation. Both of them are vehicles that you have already seen on the road today. The first one is a three-unit combination vehicle consisting of a truck, tractor, and two short trailers, 28 and a half feet long. Those look just like the trailers that you see UPS using now. They're called short doubles. The difference between them is that when UPS uses them now, they are transporting much less weight than is permitted in this bill, and that is the difference here. However, our engineers have looked at Trunk Highway 2, and they have determined that it is built to carry this kind of load. And also, there will be additional axles on this vehicle. It will be a 9-axle vehicle, and the more axles you spread the weight over, the less damage it does to the road. So that this vehicle does less damage transporting the same amount of product to Duluth than if we had the same amount of product in 5-axle 80,000-pound semi-trailers, which would be legal today. In addition, the department wanted some limitations put on this. This particular vehicle does not get the benefit of the additional weight during winter load increases, and we felt that was necessary, and so that was agreed to as well. And in addition, we're requiring that it comply with all of the existing axle weight limits in the statute and with the tire weight limits, because those are important in spreading the weight over the road. In addition, this bill provides that a two-unit vehicle may be used, and this vehicle is just like the vehicle that was authorized by the legislature last year to haul extra weight for timber haulers out of the forest and to the mill. And this is a 6-axle truck, tractor, semi-trailer with a maximum gross vehicle weight permitted of 90,000 pounds, just like last year, and a maximum gross vehicle weight during winter load increases of 98,000 pounds, just like last year. Both vehicles must comply with restrictions imposed in the spring during spring load restrictions. And then some additional restrictions were imposed. One was that neither vehicle can be operated on the interstate highway system. And with respect to Duluth, that means I-35 and all of the 535 bridges and the ring around 35. That is a requirement of federal law, and that's something that we are required to enforce in Minnesota. We also, last year you may recall, there was a lot of discussion about the effect of these vehicles on local roads. And so we felt it was appropriate that the bill include a restriction that none of these vehicles could be operated on city or county streets without the approval of local authorities. And it is not our job to get that approval. Whoever wants to operate the vehicles must do that, work with the local authorities. And then, in addition, we requested a permit fee of $850 on an annual basis so that we would only be issuing this once a year for each vehicle, and that be deposited in the Trunk Highway Fund and cover the costs of administering the program. And you may recall that I talked to, I think it was the Policy Committee, actually, which some of you are on, about the department's desire that the legislature not pass additional bills increasing truck weight this year, and let us do a system-wide look at this. And so we talked about that, and this bill has a delayed effective date. It will not take effect as it's written until August 1st of 2006, so that it does not provide any advantage that is not available to other people who want to use heavy trucks, who have agreed to step back and participate in a study with us. And so with all of those conditions in this bill, our engineers feel that these trucks are completely acceptable vehicles to protect the roads and the bridges of Minnesota, and we have no reservations about this.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Parker? Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. for anyone who wants to answer. I earlier there was testimony by Mr. Maher that there are 70 trucks currently traveling carrying the load. How would this change that?
Mr. Maher.
Thank you, Representative Ruth, Madam Chair. Considering if a machine were to go, the tonnage that would be put out of the mill, it could be up to 70 trucks. And if, looking at the difference in weights here, if we were doing 70 trucks, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, conventionally, with this proposal here, we would be less than 40 trucks. So that gives the difference.
Hey, any additional questions? Representative Larson.
Well, it's not a question, Madam Chair. It's a comment. I just want to say I thank Representative Solberg and the folks from Blennon for coming forward and asking permission rather than forgiveness.
it's true.
I mean, really, I think we've been going through an exercise in this committee of having to give our forgiveness to folks that have chosen to break the law. And we do it with garbage trucks, and we do it with utility trucks and whatever. And I guess I appreciate that perhaps the model we ought to be looking at is if one needs to use the road efficiently with a heavier load, we look at changing the axle rather than changing the law. That's the only comment I want to make.
And any additional questions or comments? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at your white sheet here with the cost of captivity by industry. You've got captive rate here and your non-captive rate for pulp and paper. Can you just give a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of what that's about?
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Buckler. I'm the legislative representative for Blandon, UPM. And the sheet that you have in front of you is from the Rail Price Advisor, which is an independent consulting service, I believe headquartered in Baltimore, anyway, one of the East Coast cities. It compiles data from the Association of American Railroads, which is the national trade association of the major railroads. This is really an issue for the Congress, the issue of rail captivity, but for purposes of understanding it, a captive shipper is one that is served only by one railroad. In this case, the UPM Blandon Mill in Grand Rapids, Minnesota is served by only one railroad. And as such, the rates and those figures are average rates across the United States tend to be substantially greater than for shippers who have access to competitive bidding circumstances among railroads. So for purposes of the situation at hand here, UPM Blandon, unless it can have its product in Duluth for shipment to markets throughout the United States, has access only to one railroad. If the product is able to be in Duluth, the company can receive competitive bids, including a bid from the railroad that serves at Grand Rapids. And you'll see in the non-captive line, you'll see the difference of quite a substantial difference. So I believe, and I'm not looking at the sheet, but I believe the captivity premium is something like $35 per ton, just under $35 per ton. So if you take a look at the numbers that Mr. Maher provided you with, the current production is at around 500,000 tons annually, and it will go with the new machine to 750,000 tons or thereabouts annually. That becomes quite a large number in the tens of millions of dollars annually represented by that premium. So therefore the importance of having a competitive option, and the bill, Representative Nelson's amendment, would permit that competitive option to be in effect by permitting the company in a very specified way to access the port of Duluth for shipment of its product.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody in the audience would like to speak in opposition to this bill? Are there any additional questions of the bill authors, Representative Solberg, or their testifiers?
First of all, I want to thank Representative Nelson for inviting me down. This is extremely important. He's the chief author. I've added my name on it. But it's a little bit unusual to have this kind of a bipartisan love-in, but I appreciate that very much. And it is extremely important for us, and I appreciate you scheduling the hearing as well.
And Representative Solberg, maybe you can come back 2 weeks from today when we do our omnibus bill and help us continue in this tradition.
Madam Chair, if I can be of help with a bipartisan love-in, I'll...
Thank you.
Madam Chair, one final comment, and Ms. Parker talked to you about the effective date being put off to 2006, and I think it's also incumbent upon you to realize also if this project does not come to fruition, all bets are off. And so this is not just a carte blanche type of thing. This is definitely project specific. We're not going to open the door up for all sorts of other things that might happen. So with that, I thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Right. Thank you, Representative Nelson, and please take the necessary steps to make sure that we get an updated fiscal note as soon as possible. We're going to start working on our omnibus bill here soon, and we need to know whether we have to look at this or we can send this bill along separate. And with that, if there's no additional...
There is somebody here.
I'm sorry. Oh, you're going to ruin this love-in with some negativity? Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matthew Lampkin. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. I'm here on behalf of Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And unfortunately, yes, I am here to ruin this love-in. And I'm not exactly the right messenger. They're on their way over. We just saw that this came up. There's some negotiations going on between some different individuals in the railroad, and these negotiations are in the process, is my understanding. So we'd like maybe to work with the author and Representative Solberg as things move forward, but there are definitely two sides to this issue, and there is definite controversy with doing this from our perspective.
Thank you for your comments for the record, and we'll look forward to the next chapter of this story. Members, with that, I'll... renew my motion that House File 1400 as amended be laid over for possible consideration for the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill.
Thank you. Chair members.
All right, the next item on the agenda is Representative Ruth. Actually, has two bills on the agenda for today. Representative Ruth, do you want to go with personalized veterans plates first?
Yes.
All right. That would be House File 1782. And members, both of these license plate bills will be held over for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you already move the bill?
No. Pardon?
Did you move the bill?
I did not. I just stated that they being held over. I thought as a member of the committee you might want to move your...
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I want to move House File 1782 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill. And this, members, is a bill to authorize personalized veterans license plates. We have already... in the past have veterans personalized plates on a regular license plate, but this bill just extends it to be the same authorizations to veterans license plate. And also the public Department of Public Safety is changing their mainframe system, so it'll be less expensive to do it if we wait until 2006. So that's the effective date of this bill. And with that, I would like to introduce Vincent Anderson, a veteran who will speak to the issue as well.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Anderson. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
My name is Vincent Anderson. Madam Chair, representatives, over the past weeks I've polled three different veterans groups, a total of 81 people polled. 38 of those 81 have an interest in purchasing personalized veterans plates. 32 were very adamant about The addition of slashes, dashes, and spaces as characters and having up to 7 characters like the civilian personalized plates, with the understanding that any more than 5 characters would delete the service medal sticker on the left side. The significance being the ability to put their unit designation on their license plates. I've spoken with Mr. Tom Evans, Department of Transportation, Special License Plates Division. He assured me that all these changes can be done administratively using the newer style of veterans' plates. As Representative Ruth said, this is going to be some time before it's enacted. I guess the main thing being that the Department of Transportation is going to change their computer system in July. I guess additionally, besides what I was told by Mr. Evans to be a $1,000 to $2,000 setup cost to program the computer, using the existing style license plates would be a $150 charge for making a die or stamp for slashes and dashes if we don't already have dashes incorporated in our plates. And if that was a big deal, I'd pay for those myself.
That's on the record.
You bet. A workup of combinations of unit designations using slashes, dashes, and spaces, and have yet to complete a survey of law enforcement agencies. I'm doing this to see if these additional characters create any problems in recognition for law enforcement. And I will let Mr. Tom Evans and Representative Ruth know the results of that survey.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
As far as what it means to me personally and in brief, no honor to be a part of something that can be meaningful to other veterans.
All right. Thank you very much for coming today. Are there any questions for Mr. Anderson? Representative Anderson.
He's going to testify or form Representative Ruth or Mr. Evans. The date of the fiscal note is February 23rd. I'm wondering if the cost of this has changed or the figures for the fiscal note have changed. It shows $9,000 here for the 06, and then it goes down to a negative, or looks like $11,000 for 07, but this doesn't go into effect until 06, I believe. So I'm just asking if that's changed or if that's still a good number.
Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're representatives. My name is Tom Evans. I'm the supervisor of the Special Plate Unit for Driver and Vehicle Services, Division of Public Safety. This is fairly current. The reason for some of the changes or some of the discrepancies is there are many different kinds of veteran plates. There's multiple categories, and when I talked to Mr. Anderson here, I told him what the programming cost would be approximately per category. This is subject to many that were scheduled to be removed from in July. So the new server-based system would be much more cost-effective.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans. On the back of that fiscal note, it says the programming cost of $20,000 is estimated for this fall of 2005, and you're saying that by the fall of, or by next year, it's going to go down to $9,000?
Mr. Evans.
Chairman, Representative Anderson, the original programming costs that came in for our current mainframe system was in the neighborhood of $100,000. The $20,000 reflects the a change to the new server-based system, which is unfortunately not in effect, and the programming costs are really a stab in the dark at this point. There's a possibility that it depends a lot on how the programming can be accomplished. If it can be accomplished across the board for all plates, it would be much less than it would be to individually program each category.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Evans, how soon would you know, or what's the timeline on? You're saying you're guesstimating in this here. Any idea when that's going to be finalized?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, unfortunately the numbers I received were from our enterprise support group, and I have not gotten any new numbers from them, and at this point, I think we'll be lucky to see any changes by this July. So I'm afraid the numbers and the actual fiscal impact here is really up in the air at this point.
Representative Anderson?
Never
mind. All right. Representative
Leader. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and I forgot the person's name from the department.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Evans?
Mm-hmm.
It appears to me and to Mr. Anderson, a personalized veterans plate, and I'm a veteran again, if I'd just like to reiterate that so they're aware of it. But we have many different types of units, and just what you had said now, if every veteran comes in for a different type of unit, you're probably lucky if you have five from one unit within the state. I don't know how many veterans there are. We all belong to different units, and basically, as I understand it, this is a personal license plate. I think the cost would be terrific, and we only can recoup those costs that are attributable to that particular license plate. So you'd have a lot of variance as far as billing every time you got a plate. Wouldn't that be correct?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Leader, currently we have the personalized plate program in effect for the regular plates, and there's a $100 fee for that. That would continue for this new category. Any veteran would have to also pay the $100 for the personalized plates. And the change that we have to do in programming is that right now the system can only accept so many characters and so many identifying flags that we put on the system. Currently, we're limited to three. It's possible that with this personalization, we had Vietnam veteran, disability, and personalized plate types of identifiers on one record, perhaps even more. But right now, there would be some limitations on how many. If two people want the same unit number, only one of them is going to be able to get it.
Representative Leader, did you have an additional follow-up question? Representative Leader, do you have a follow-up question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and again, maybe I don't understand what they're talking about, personalized plates. Is that a plate like somebody says, my name is Billy Joe, and they want that, or is this when they want a unit identification, plus they're a disabled vet, and they're a combat vet, and they're an Air Force vet? We can just well throw away the numbers and make a plate for strictly veterans. I think we're really going down the wrong road, Madam Chair. And I can, again, Mr. Anderson, I can agree, you can pull 81 members. I can take any one of these groups we had. We had the MCCL, we had the other opposite group, we had the Vikings. They can pull their members and say, yeah, we got so many members, I'll say they'll want this plate or buy it. But I think we're really creating a nightmare in this, as far as the state goes, to create license plates, and the fact that I think we're losing, again, the rationale why we have licenses. I can go in a parking lot, and I think you all can there. There's a support our troops. Just about every other vehicle's got one of those loops, support our troops. And I think we're kind of getting a little bit out of the realm that we should be, and maybe I'm misunderstanding this, Mr. Anderson, but we got nurses, we got doctors, we got farmers, they can want a plate. How many can you sign up and get me to say you want farmer's plates? I think we're really getting down the wrong road.
I'm a veteran's farmer plate.
Really?
No, I'm a veteran, too.
Madam Chair, Representative Ruth, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Leader, I think we know that we have, in the past, it has been consistent that we have had veteran's plates. We haven't added all these others, as we've talked about, but veteran's plates we have, and this would be expanding in that one, so I would hope that.
If I might, Mr. Evans, I don't know the whole story behind this, but picking up bits and pieces, my understanding is that you're going to a different type of plate, whether from not from embossed or stamped, but rather a flat plate that they'll be able to program through a computer more readily than the current plates, and I think that plays into the programming and the costs, and maybe we need a little, just very short primer on why the change in the structure of the plate is going to make a difference in the ability to issue these types of plates.
Madam Chair, representatives, currently we use a technology that's about 50 years old in producing our plates. I mean, you may have seen the loom plates are produced separately for us by 3M. They're a flat plate. And there is quite a bit of interest in switching the department over statewide to that type of plate. Right now we're waiting for some competing technologies to catch up with the current one, hopefully to bring prices down. 2 years ago we did a report for the legislature that estimated adopting the flat plate would be an extra cost of $3 million. And we're hoping that that would come down quite a bit with this competing technology. And that should be sometime right after the first of the year. That combined with our change in the system would greatly reduce the cost of producing these plates, would increase our flexibility in issuing them. We wouldn't have to wait so long. Right now it can take 1 to 2 months to get a personalized plate depending on how it's applied for. In the future, the production line doesn't have to be shut down on the flat plate technology. It's all programmed into the system. It's basically like a giant laser printer, if you will, that prints, it can print out a loom plate, a Vietnam veteran plate, 100 regular plates, or WX plates, whatever. So it is much more flexible, and hopefully it's something that we can invest ourselves in.
Okay, Representative Earhart.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We're not talking about big cars now. We're talking about actually burning them in on a flat piece of steel.
Representative Earhart, the personal plates are like the personal plates for regular plates or the natural habitat plates, where you would choose your slogan.
Well, I'm not sure. There are differences between getting Ron on a sticker, on a plate as a sticker and having it cut that way or stamped that way and getting Ron on one of the outdoor plates, whatever they are, the DNR plates, embossed or stamped. I don't know what we're talking about here. And if I'm Ron from the 34th Division that fought in World War II, am I the only one that can get Ron from the 34th Division? Is that what we're talking about, an individual personalized place?
Representative Earhart, Ron-34, or however many spaces you would have, and that would depend on the type of plate, because in some instances, on a standard plate, you get 7 characters. On some of these veterans plates, in order to leave room for the decal identifying which war group you're associated with, you're down to 5 characters, I believe. So you, if nobody else had Ron 34 and you paid your $100 and you wanted that type of plate with Ron 34, you could get it. But only you. There could not be another Ron 34 on any other
I'll
life.
I'll pay for that myself.
I think this is getting really carried away. I'll go along with Representative Leader here.
Representative Earhart, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill. We want to get the most important points on the table today, and I'm sure we'll have much more discussion about license plates. And we do have one additional bill today. Mr. Anderson, did you want to have some closing statements at this time?
In particular, thank you, Madam Chair. In particular, Representative Leader's question or comments. I guess number one, by people doing simple things like adding one, meaning first platoon, C Company 322, and whether they have slashes or dashes, just off the top of my head, I come up with about 20 combinations of license plates that an individual could have belonging to the same infantry company. And apparently you've never served in the infantry because, and if you have, it's been a long time ago, because the guys I was with are well adept at, the only word I can think of is bastardizing situations. They're ingenious, believe me.
All right, any additional comments? Representative Ruth, would you like to renew your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to renew my motion to lay over House File 1782 for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance
Bill. Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Ruth. We have one more bill on the table before us on the agenda. That's House File 2058, Representative Ruth, Knights of Columbus Special License Plates Authorized. Again, members, this will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill. And Representative Ruth, I see a number of testifiers here today, and certainly we're happy to hear the information, but I think the majority of us heard this bill as well in policy, just as the previous bill. So, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will move House File 2058 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Ruth.
And this is the Knights of Columbus special license plate authorized. And, yes, I think most of the members did hear this in the policy committee, and we are limited with this time. But we do have Willard Strand, our deputy Knights of Columbus, and I would like to introduce him and just remind everybody that we do have a very active Knights of Columbus in all of our communities, and you know, they're very responsible and very very strong in donating to whatever is going on in the community. It's an active organization with active members that are contributing, and so just to keep that in mind as you hear your testimony.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Strand. Thank you for coming today. If you'll state your name for the record and your testimony, please.
Thank you. I'm Willard Strand, State Deputy for the Knights of Columbus, Madam Chair, committee members. I know the other day, or last time I was here, I mentioned some of the things about it, but like we are, we do have over 44,000 members in the state of Minnesota. Our Knights are all volunteers and receive no compensation for what they do, not even me. I don't get a dime for doing it. But our principal charity, one of the first principles of our order is charity. One of the things I'd like to point out is that if you drive along the countryside in Minnesota, I don't think there's a highway in Minnesota that doesn't have a sign up there on Clean Up the Highway with Knights of Columbus name on it. We do clean up many miles of highway in the state of Minnesota. In 2003, the Knights donated over $3 million and 1.2 million hours of volunteer service in the state of Minnesota. Quite a bit of that went for community, church, family, and youth activities. And I think another thing we do, as I mentioned, the end of this month, we do have our Tootsie Roll campaign coming up. You'll see our men out there handing out Tootsie Rolls, collecting money for people with mental disabilities. And I don't know, one of the unique things about the Knights of Columbus, too, even though we are a fraternal benefit organization, over half of our members are not insurance members. They join simply because they want to be able to be a part of this organization. And I feel that having a license with our emblem on it is a way for our members to be rewarded for all of the volunteer hours that they do in and for their communities, in a way to show the pride in what they do. With an organization that has 1.7 million members, it's kind of nice for us to be able to drive into another state and somebody recognize us as being a member of the Knights of Columbus. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Mr. Strand, are you aware of any other states that have Knights of Columbus plates?
Yes, Madam Chair. I know that North Dakota does. I know Ohio does. Maryland does. I'm not sure of all of them, but I mean, those are, Texas, I believe, does. So there are a number of them out there that do have the plate.
All right, thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask Mr. Williams a question. As I remember, at Knights of Columbus are a religious affiliate or religious organization or semi-religious or something in that nature with the Catholic Church. And I think we're crossing the bounds of church and state here. And I prefer not to have the advertising for the Catholic Church.
What's the question for Mr. Williams?
The question is, are there any other church affiliates that have special license plates?
Churches? Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart in Minnesota, no.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions, comments? Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I will renew my motion to the over House File 2058 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Votes nay. Motion's adopted. Thank you. So, members, I have two chapters of good news, bad news for the committee. The first is Ms. Gervin has taken a new job. She will be the Director of Constituent Services for the House Republican Caucus. So she's going to hang with us for a while, but her job has been posted, and we may have a new committee administrator before the end of session, or she might be totally worn out and nearly dead by the end of session doing two jobs. So we'll see how that works out. The second good news, bad news is today is the bad, this is the bad news, is our last day that we will have a page Lucas Ness with us. He's done a great job for us. I'm not very happy that he's leaving, but I have nothing to say about it, of course. The good news is that he has taken a job with the Republican Senate Caucus as the LA for their research department, so we will still see him in the hallways, and he'll be in the building. So certainly he's done a great job for us, and we'll miss him. And I have not a clue who our new page will be, but hopefully next Tuesday we'll know that as well. So best wishes to you. You've done a great job for us, and you guys do the work that nobody really notices, but we're glad you're there when we need you. So thank you. Any other issues to come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.